This is a test. This is a test. This is Peter Black. Today is July 16th, 2006. We're in Malakal Port in Karor, and this is an interview with Lynn Wickersham Palloy, a former Peace Corps volunteer in Palau. So then the first thing that would be, I guess, logical to start with is why you joined the Peace Corps in the first place, what was going on in kind of your life, or just what led you to that decision?
Well, my older brother, who's 4 years older, he was a volunteer in Venezuela. So I think that's what sparked my interest. And I had, between my junior and senior year of college, I got a phone call and a letter that I'd been accepted to a program in Nigeria for after graduation, but they wanted me to do the summer in Dartmouth for training, but I declined that. But then during the spring of my senior year of college, there was a recruiting table at the Student Union Center, there was this lovely poster of this yuppiest couple on a motorcycle. I think it was a blow up something from National Geographic. And I just went up to the table and I said, pick me, I'm yours.
Uh-huh.
Meaning that I had already been accepted in the Peace Corps and I wasn't having success finding teaching positions. I was limiting myself to the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so I just went up and I said, really? I said, pick me, I'm yours. And then I got my name and pulled out my files and I heard from them, and the thing I knew was getting ready to go to Key West.
So, could you say a few words about your family and where you went to college and what you made
you do? I was born and grew up in Seattle, Washington. I went to Washington State University over in Pullman. Majored in education. Just have the one brother who was 4 years older. I'd always wanted to be a teacher, so that was my education major, so I knew that would fit in well with what Peace Corps had planned for me. Even though my brother had gone to Venezuela and did his 4 years as Peace Corps, or two years as Peace Corps, my father was not pleased at all with the idea of me coming out here. He was very against it. Not that I'm that close with my father, not the idea that I don't think he was worried about my safety or whatever, but just something I didn't really realize then so much that he was prejudiced against brown-skinned people and didn't like the whole idea of me coming out here, thought it a waste of my good education. But I was very adamant that this is what I wanted to do and this is what I was going to do.
So your brother supported?
Yes, actually he met a woman in Venezuela and came back to Seattle for a visit before returning to Venezuela, working for Eli Lilly. So anyway, he was able to stop in Miami during my training period and we saw each other.
And you were part of that famous Micro One training group.
Oh yes.
So what can you tell us about that?
Well, we were so many, and they were what they called deselected left and right throughout the training period. But they started out, you know, just getting anybody basically right out of college for this Micro One program down in Casa Marina Hotel in Key West, Florida. All of the Micronesian volunteers, we were all together in this hotel. But we were so with our own group that we really didn't, and we had our own schedules, kind of rotating the schedule, that we didn't really have much opportunity to meet the volunteers going to the other Micronesian entities. But I remember very painfully the Saturday morning language test that they would give us.
Who were your languages from?
Oh, gosh. I just had their names. Robert Tochi, Caleb Ogril, Chiro Moroz, Mr. Onglumul, Victor Ruor, John Stoll, two women were Emmy Kahama and Mofako Sisura.
Uh-huh.
And they're all deceased now. They're all passed away. They were all teachers.
Uh-huh.
And I realize now that they gave up an awful lot to come so far away from their families for the 3 months.
Yeah.
It was probably their income for them. The Uncle Sam was paying for it.
I remember our, not so much the plowing when it was teachers, but especially the ones from Kosrae and Ponte, they were just kind of freaked by it when we were in Honolulu. It was the big city, right? Just different traffic.
Yeah. And then Father, well, he wasn't yet Father Kelly, but Felix Yao was training at Woodstock at that time, and so he was hired and came down for a week or so and spoke to us.
Culture stuff.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the training all these years later?
Well, it was such a new experience. It was just, it's really so unforgettable. I mean, we had the time in Key West, and then we went out to these smaller islands called Little Munson, where we camped.
Uh-huh.
So we dealt with learning how to pump the Coleman lantern.
Uh-huh.
We learned how to fight the mosquitoes.
Uh-huh.
Scale a fish, or you know, these cultural things. That, and we had a, and then we spent some time in Miami, stayed in a hotel, and then we were doing, going out in small groups in communities. So I remember going to like kind of impoverished neighborhoods with a community worker, social worker, I guess, kind of meeting one-on-one people. I don't know what really it was training us for. Maybe the best part of our training that was relevant to coming here was the hurricane that we had.
Oh, really?
A really, really bad hurricane. And I remember was sitting on the floor of the hotel just watching the wind and the rain just whipping by housebound for the duration.
Uh-huh.
And then all the shots that we had to get. That was a memorable part of the training. They didn't know what diseases were here, and so they were shooting, you know, giving us immunizations for everything. And some people got really, really sick.
Uh-huh.
Big doses of whatever.
Were most of the people have an education background?
No. They were, a lot of them were, they classified them as generalists.
Right.
As long as they had a college degree and they were young and willing, you know, that was all that was really necessary. But one of my last memories of Key West was those of us that were selected got these huge gamma globulin shots. And we're sitting on the floor of a hotel. I guess they didn't have many chairs, with these really sore butts. You know, and those that were had not been selected were packing off and going home, you know, and we didn't know who was in a better situation at that point. But then we got to go home for like 10 days to pack and whatnot. And then we all met in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
And flew out of Oakland on a charter flight.
Really? To Guam?
To Guam. So from Oakland to Guam. And then a lot of the Micronesians were on that flight too, coming home. But we were well fed. I mean, we had champagne and And then we spent a couple of nights in Guam. So like our last
Micro Hotel? Probably, the old Micro, right.
And then went to the old townhouse to buy aloha shirts and muumuus, you know, to come to the islands.
So, why don't you say a few words about your first impressions of Guam, settling in the area?
Certainly the beauty of the place really struck me. And I remember driving in from the airport into Kalor and looking down out of the bus window, looking down at the terraced gardens and the tapioca gardens and other, just how beautiful it was, so green. Just really breathtakingly beautiful. We all stayed in a bai.
Which one?
Well, it's no longer that. I don't remember the name of it. Maybe Bai Ramakapili. It's near where Shirsave is now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, down the road down to Kidal. But we stayed that we were all, I think by the time we came out there were 26 of us that finally made it. Seven, you know, some of the rest of the guys. So we were all in just this one big room in the Abai. and I guess community people brought pillows, you know, mm-hmm. and sheets for us, but we had no place, no privacy. So we, the girls, we'd take turns holding the sheet up so we could change our clothes. But being the first group of so many white-skinned Americans that clowns weren't used to, we had, I remember there were slats all around the abaya, and there'd just be little brown faces. All the kids would just come, and they were just so curious to see how we slept, how we ate, and everything. And then the community, different hamlets, were assigned to feed us, so it was just like trying to outdo each other, you know. So all this food for every meal, and then we were taken around and met some of the Trust Territory employees mm-hmm. and given like further just kind of introduction about what we're going to be doing mm-hmm. and who was who and so on.
Bound Up is already here?
Yes, Bound Up is here. So we were in Peru for about a week and then we were set out to mm-hmm. our sites. I was assigned to Mesa.
Which is in the Big Island.
Right, on the east coast, the first village past the past island.
Mm-hmm. Nice beach.
No beach.
No beach.
No beach in Nisa, it's mangrove.
Oh,
so it's like on that side where everything else does have beaches, but Nisa, no beach.
So you stayed with a family?
No, actually, we didn't. Been tied up by Calvin, but I didn't last there too long. Jean, Mary, and I were assigned to a house owned by a family, but the family was actually in Kavor. So it was just the two of us there, and the house actually had been lived in by the previous year by an American teacher. They had these contract teachers. So there was like a bed there and some furniture, but
plumbing?
No, there was an outdoor banjo, an outdoor shower.
What was the school like?
The school, I don't know. I was assigned to teach like Thursday. For some reason, I just freaked out.
Really?
I think I had culture shock. And it just wasn't the right fit for me. Jean and I were friends, but not really, really close.
Right.
And I just didn't feel that it was a good mix for us to be together.
What did you do about your food? You guys couldn't
do that? Well, we started to, but then some woman was cooked for us and we paid her a little bit.
Your laundry stuff?
I remember doing my own laundry and how in the heck you're supposed to wash by hand sheets and wring sheets and hang them on the line. And I remember we could never get the Coleman lantern going, so we'd always have to call somebody down to help, you know, pump it and get it going. Because the house had been occupied by this contract teacher, there was also a kerosene refrigerator there.
Oh, that's nice.
But I felt kind of guilty about using it because we were supposed to be roughing it. And like I wouldn't sleep on the bed because we were supposed to be roughing it, you know. So. And there was only one bed and two of us where we could have probably each had a mattress, but we were trying, you know, to tough it out.
Right.
Anyway, right after the Christmas break, where we all came into Karora for further training, and then I just kind of broke down. But I didn't want to go home,
mm-hmm.
so they just reassigned me to Karora.
So when did you, actually, what month did you get to Karora?
We came in November 6th.
November 6th.
1966.
That was the first wave.
The first wave. It was a Sunday. I will never forget that day. So when I was transferred into Peror, and then there was a woman in my group who left, was getting ready to leave just before Typhoon Sally.
Uh-huh.
That certainly kind of
blew
her away. And then, so then there was a need for another teacher in there, so that's why I ended up. Because they had a number of, I think they maybe had six or eight volunteers there, you know, at all grade levels, they wanted this immersion of English. I ran into a teacher this last week at the teacher's Pacific
Tech.
And recognized her. I'm glad to know you're a teacher. She said, yes. I still remember when I was in first grade and you were our language teacher, and that's when we first got there.
Wow.
So So a lot of my former students still remember. Some of them, I think, are still in therapy over the this frightening tall white American woman, you know, coming in and forcing them to speak English. For some, it was a terrifying experience.
I can imagine that. So then you're in Maristella, and where were you living?
Well, I lived with on the main road first with a family that had a store in front, so that's the Asanuma family. And then right after Typhoon Sally, I moved in with Father Felix Yao's mother, who was a widow and lived alone. That was in Yerba Ave.
That's February 2000.
So about March or April of 67, after the typhoon, because she had some damage from Baulus, who was her relative, had to fix up her house. And I was there for about 6 or 8 months. And then, because there's this two women alone in the house, some neighborhood men would come and kind of like knock on the window at night and want in, and that really was frightening to me, and I couldn't sleep. So I found a family in Sayron and Yermakati, and I moved in with them, and they had a lot of kids that were at my Stella.
And Miramai and these other place names you've mentioned, Hamlet,
Hamlet,
town of Korea.
Yes, yes.
Say a word or two about the school.
About Maristella?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when I first went there, the Mercedarian missionary sisters were running the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not a Catholic at the time, so I was very unfamiliar about nuns in white habits and saying rosaries and talking to Mother Angelica and all this, but they were very warm and gracious to me, and really made me feel comfortable.
And it's the elementary school for the Catholic school system.
Right, just the one elementary school, and then Zenti is the high school that was just across the school.
So, you spent the rest of your tour as a teaching in Mazzetti?
No, I spent the 2 years teaching just at Maristella.
At Maristella, so.
Yeah, but during that time is when I met Juan,
uh-huh.
Aloy, and he was actually he just graduated from Canisius College, and so he had just come back.
Canisius in Buffalo.
In Buffalo, right. The Jesuits sent him there with his education. He was teaching at the high school, so we met at an Agnosticus ceremony after the birth of the first child.
Uh-huh.
Kathy Kesselay had invited all the priests to come up. It was her sister's Agnosticus. And it was right across from this bar called the Boom Boom Room, the famous Boom Boom Room.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, they gave us, they brought plates of food, and we had no place to sit down there. And so her uncle Robert owned the Boom Boom, so Kathy got Robert to open up the Boom Boom on Sunday afternoon, closed of course, but we went in, this group of volunteers, and we were sitting down, and then Juan and his cousin, Isidore Rudin, were there checking out the Peace Corps, and they came over, and that's when I first met him in the Boom Boom.
That's interesting.
And that's the reason why I extended a third year, to kind of see if I really wanted to if things were going to work out, we were going to get married, and this is where I would spend the rest of my life.
So, and what did you do for your third year?
The same. I was still at Maristella teaching. Yeah. And by that third year, really, I was feeling much more comfortable about the teaching and really getting into it. I think it takes at least that many years, to kind of get the feel of what's going on.
In addition to teaching, what other kinds of things did you get involved in?
During the summer, we were supposed to be working.
Right.
And so, kind of on my own initiative, and with Steve Lewis, who was also in my group, we did this waitress training program. Because we felt that the waitresses here didn't really know how to properly set the table and where to serve from which side and remove from. So we just did this little set of our own waitress training program. And then also, maybe it was my third year at Maristella, although it might have been after I was finished being a volunteer because I continued to teach. But anyway, I started a Girl Scout group. There was a, for a few years, there was a Girl Scout program here. And so I had a Girl Scout group over there. So.
Have you been a scout?
Of course!
Have you been a camper?
A little bit.
A little bit?
Yeah.
Had you ever been to tropical islands before?
No. Never been out of Washington
State
because I went to Miami for the, you know, Florida for training and then all the way out here.
Well, maybe you could just reflect a little bit on your actual 3 years as a volunteer. What came out of it for you, you must have thought about it.
No, I guess I felt that this was a place where I felt really comfortable. I liked the idea of being far away from my parents. and I just felt that this was a place where I could contribute something. I guess, basically it was a place where I felt comfortable.
Yeah. It's really interesting. This is just a house. So many people felt exactly the opposite.
Really?
But then there are others who just felt, as you say, just as the opposite.
I don't know, I just had a very comfortable feeling about it. And because Juan, when we met and then we got serious and talked about marriage, and he had, come back with his sociology degree and felt that the reason he went to college was that he could come back and help Palauans develop, and that this was where he would want to be, to stay. And so was I willing to...
So that was part of the decision.
Yeah, was I willing to stay here?
Yeah.
And I liked it.
And you have.
Yes.
So we can talk about that. Because it's not every volunteer that stays. And leads their life. So when did you and Juan get married?
We got married on December
1969,
which was his birthday. Uh-huh. And he decided that we would get married then because he said he knew that anniversaries, remembering anniversaries and birthdays and so on were something important to Americans. There's Palauans don't really celebrate that kind of event. And so we would get married on his birthday, and that would help him remember. I kind of wanted to get married early in the year, but then one of his younger sisters ended up getting married on August 15th, which is a big celebration here in the Catholic Church. It's a holy day for the Catholic Church, but it's also when Palauans kind of celebrate the end of World War II when they got their freedom. So that was that was one sister-in-law. And then the other sister-in-law, Tua and Roman, snuck in their wedding in October. But by that time, we had already settled on December.
So being three weddings in the same year?
Three weddings in the 1 year, yeah.
So, and your wedding was here?
It was here in Palauan at the Catholic Church. Uh-huh. Not a real big wedding.
Did you become a Catholic in
I was thinking about it. Although Juan nor his family never really pushed me. Did you know Father Edwin McManus?
Sure, and Father Horner also.
Yes. Well, Father McManus had a heart attack up in Rorada in September of 69. And somehow that just kind of, something clicked after that, and I started thinking more about God and that I needed and wanted to have religion in my life. And I said, well, maybe it was even kind of a faithful move that I ended up being at the Catholic school and so on. So. I was baptized on Christmas Eve in 69, and then we got married 3 days later. And Father Hoare was one of the people down there. Because Juan had lived with his brother when he was in Buffalo. Juan taught Father Hoare language.
So, did any of your family come from there?
No. My parents, they hadn't met Juan, but just the whole idea of staying here, they weren't keen on it. And so they said they wouldn't come, but it didn't surprise me, you know. It was, they were supportive, and then they sent money, and I printed the invitations and so on. And so they did their kind of their part from Seattle. But they chose not to come. But I, years later, in 92, after my father died, and my brother and I were there, and my mom cleaned out my dad's stuff, and my mom said, you know, I always wanted to come to your wedding, but your brother didn't want to.
Well, what mother does want to do?
So I didn't have, but I had one of the, my Peace Corps friends, Carol, who was in my group. She was my matron of honor. And then Ron asked his cousin Isidore to do it to be the best man.
So, and then you just kind of carried on teaching?
I finished out that year. I was then a lay teacher, but still at Maristel. So I finished out that year, and then got pregnant in the spring. And then in the summer we went for 2 months to the state. It was like our honeymoon. We went from the West Coast to the East Coast, back to the West Coast. It was a lot of traveling. And then when we got back here in August, but the whole time I was like morning sickness, morning, noon, and night. But anyway, I lost the baby when we got back. I had a miscarriage. It's my only daughter. And I had decided on a name, Julia. Catherine, who was a great-great-grandmother on my mother's side. But that's not like Peter's daughter, my oldest son's daughter. It really? Was Julia, his older sister. So I think I digressed from your question, but... So after that, when I was pregnant, we came back, and then I wasn't going to teach. So basically, during the 70s, then I was pregnant, had my four kids, you know, first one in 72, the last one in 79. But I did some, like, part-time teaching, some English tutoring. I did my own little kindergarten thing for a couple of years with Peter and then some other kids. 1 year at the house, another year with Tua. Set up a room for us, just about five kids, so that was kind of fun. But basically, more home than not during the 70s, and then we're back into teaching and working full time in the end of 79.
So when you were a volunteer, how did you make your abilities become?
Well, zero plus, gonna finish language training in Key West.
Right.
But obviously that wasn't, I guess, the highest priority of what they were looking for, you know, because I was selected. So I guess it was...
So you came here, you didn't really...
Didn't really speak it, and then being at Maristella, the first teaching English, and then the lay teachers, of course there were a number of other Peace Corps, but there were also Palawan lay teachers. But they spoke enough English, so I really didn't have to use it in my job.
Right.
And my family wanted me to use it with their kids. It wasn't really until after I was married and living with my in-laws, and I could hear them talking about, talking in Palawan, and the only thing every once in a while I'd hear Lynn, and then something else, Lynn. And so I decided, they're talking about me. I don't know if they're saying good things or bad things, but that was really my motivation to get with it with my Palawan. So.
And now you're fluent?
Pretty much, yeah. I can pretty much carry on Palawan. And I guess Palawans, they like assume that I speak Palawan because without...
Well, you have that reputation, people. Your name comes up. They're discussing who can speak Palawan.
Because people will start speaking Palawan to me. That I haven't really met before. So I think it's good for me to be able to still communicate in another language. It kind of keeps the brain cells clicking.
So now you're back in Palau, you're teaching the Palau Community College of Song, and what you're planning on doing to Hilo for a while.
Right.
Are you going to stay in Hilo or are you going back there?
Well, I just don't know.
All right.
Supposedly I'm going for 1 year to take care of my granddaughter. So we'll just see. I mean, I'd like to come back. I feel it's home.
Yeah, well,
and, this is where I spent most of my life.
Right.
I came, you know, first 22 years in Seattle and the last 40 years here. So more of my life here. It's such a small place. I've been here so long. It's like everybody knows me, you know. I like that.
Famous.
I like that.
Yeah.
You know? Even that was why Hilo didn't really feel so comfortable to me before, mm-hmm. because I didn't really have any friends. And I had my sons and their spouses' mm-hmm. families. But I didn't have my own friends. And that was the end of 2003 when I left Xavier. And I thought I really was going to relocate to mm-hmm. Hilo and get a job and settle there, blah, blah, blah. Build a house, you know.
Yeah.
And I was there just a short while. Maybe I didn't give it enough time. I have a house in Palau. I have all my friends in Palau. Why should I start all over again? And I thought, well, maybe if I had a spouse with me, it would have been a different feeling about starting something new. So I hope I'll be back after a year. We'll see.
I bet you'll be back.